morning, we're delighted to welcome you all to the Supreme Court hearing room, and we have some special guests. We have students from Lancaster High School. Would they please stand? Thank you. You may be seated. And we have students from Cedarburg High School. You may stand. Thank you for coming this morning. The students are here with a program that is sponsored by the State Bar and this court. It's entitled Court with Class. Students from around the state are invited to come here, listen to an oral argument. If they take up the invitation, then they are sent materials about the case, and they may have engaged in some activities that involve that case. They come, listen to oral argument, and then after this second case, they're joined by students who were here earlier today, and we'll meet with the justice who's assigned to meet with you today and discuss the procedures for the court hearing and deciding cases, but they will not discuss the substantive issues of the case. And everyone is welcome to come and join the students and the justice. If anyone here would like a summary of the case we are about to hear, if you'd raise your hand, the marshal will give you a summary. Let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. My immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. Justice Crooks is the justice with whom the students will meet today. Seated next to Justice Crooks is Justice Patience Robinsack. And seated to her left is Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I will call the next case, 08AP2028, Barbara, is it Greigel? Versus Manches Fish and Game Club, Inc. Representing the Greigels is attorney John Rothstein of Quarles and Brady. Counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the court. I'm very pleased to be here. In chambers with us today are Barbara Greigel and Janet Nahorn, who are my clients and the plaintiffs. They're immediately to my right, and they're very pleased to be here, too. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, should that be necessary.
Your timing was set for that.
The question that brings us here today and why Barbara Greigel and Janet Nahorn are asking for the court's assistance is I believe the Court of Appeals has changed Wisconsin law as it affects all the pertinent easements throughout the state. And so I believe that the question, although this is a very humble case, it's important to my clients, but the question for this court is, should the longstanding traditional law regarding easements and how broadly easements can be used be changed, notwithstanding traditional trespass laws, to now allow holders of limited access easements to expand their access rights for the purpose of accessing other unrelated lands, lands that are not served by the easement. The Court of Appeals in this case held that holders of pertinent easements should be allowed to expand the uses of their easements to access other non-dominant lands unless the private property owner can now show that the unrelated use or the new lands cause them undue burdens. By this new law or new ruling, the Court of Appeals decision means that the privacy and traditional ownership rights of landowners no longer apply. The standard for review is that this is another summary judgment decision. It was issued on summary judgment. I moved for summary judgment, and I believe it meets all the standards necessary for summary judgment. There are no facts in dispute here. What are the facts then? First, this is an easement case, so I'll go right to the easement. And unlike the preceding case, a riparian rights case, this is an easement that is not silent on the critical issues. The easement is in writing. It was recorded in the Register of Deeds office, and it provides as such. It's on page 7 of my brief, and I'll read it in short. For and in consideration of the sum of $1, another good and valuable consideration, receipt of which is hereby acknowledged, David J. Fruit and Alta R. Fruit, that's the predecessor of my clients, hereby grant to Melvin Voigt and Arlene Voigt, that's the predecessor of the Manchus Fish and Game Club, and their heirs and assigns an easement for the purpose of ingress and egress as a means to, and then it gives a legal description, for the land served, the northwest one quarter of the southeast one quarter, the southeast one quarter of the northeast one quarter, and the northeast one quarter of the southwest one quarter. I'm not a land surveyor, but that describes precisely in legal terms 120 acres. So unlike the preceding case, this easement very clearly on its face tells you what it is, the type of grant made, an easement, B, its purpose, it's for ingress and egress, and C, the precise lands that are benefited by it. 120 acres, you can draw it out on a map, that's what's served. For this purpose, and also because we have some high school students, I think it's worthwhile. There are two types of easement in general in this state, as in most pertinent easements and easements in gross. We actually have the first. I'll describe both. An easement in gross is really just a personal easement or a personal permission. They can give it to me and John Rothstein. I may go on Green Acre. That could be an easement. If it's such like that, unless that document says that it's transferable, it's personal to me, and it's very personal to me. That's an easement in gross. An easement appurtenant, and it's easier for me to understand, like appertains. It appertains to something. It always involves two pieces of property. The property over which the permission is given, that's called the servient estate because they have to serve. That's my client in this case. And the easement to which it appertains, it's called the dominant estate because they get to do the traveling. It is very significant that in an easement appurtenant, that's what we have here, and most easements in our state are appurtenant easements. It serves a particular piece of property. That is the definition. It serves a piece of property. When you sell the dominant estate, whether you mention it or not, you get that easement. When you sell...
Rothstein, the kicker, or one of them in this case, is what we do with milling, because that's where this burden idea comes from. And milling, when I look at it, to me, sort of sticks out like a sore thumb compared to the other case law in the area. As a general rule, it seems to me, when you look at the case law, it's gone back for a long time, 100 years probably. If you look at Rice versus Enos, more than 100, 1890. It's always been that you have the easement, it goes to that property, and you can't really expand that or change that or move that. But then you have milling, where they say, you know, it's really not that big of a burden. They bought more property. The property's right next to this property, and it's the same people, so we're going to allow that easement. Do we have to overrule milling? That's my first question. Or what do we do with it? And if you were to win. And number two, what do we do, if anything, with the 1991 court decision?
Two questions then. Milling. Milling was a court of appeals decision. It does stick out like a sore thumb. The law that you just referred to, it goes back many, many years. The general law is on an appurtenant easement, it only serves the lands circumscribed by the description. That's it. You cannot add more geography, which is what happened here. Millen, in truth, I don't think you have to overrule it. I think the Court of Appeals misconstrued its own decision. What was Millen about? It's a remedies case. It's a remedies case. What happened in Millen is that somebody had an easement, and it served a particular property, let's say 50 acres. I'm making that up, 50 acres. They bought another 50 acres right next to it. Well, the servient owner didn't like that. So they moved, not to say you abused it, you're serving the 50 acres, I want damages, I want an injunction. No, they asked for the remedy of extinguishment. They wanted the whole easement gone. And the only proof at that stage is that they bought more property. And I think Millen said at that point, simply buying more property and not showing an abuse on the remedies, we're not going to extinguish the easement. That's not enough. Now, had the case been about, wait a minute, you have people on that extra new 50 acres coming over and using the easement, that'd be different. That'd be our case. So I think the Millen case is a question of remedies And if you're looking at the remedies of extinguishment, permanent extinguishment, well, maybe burden comes in there. But that's not this case. This is simply an abuse of an existing easement beyond the permission, and it's a trespass, and whether or not there should be a remedy for the homeowner so that they can control their own property. Your second, that's number one. So I don't believe that Millen has to be overruled, but it certainly has to be properly understood. And I will say this also for Millen. Millen made very clear in the conclusion about this is not to say, this is the Millen court talking now a while back, this is not to say that an appurtenant easement can be expanded, and it referred back to an earlier case, which is exactly what we're talking about here, and that earlier case was Kresge versus Winkleman. And the Kresge versus Winkleman is exactly what we have here. Somebody was using an easement not to get to their permitted property, but to get to someplace else. And what did they do? They stopped that. That's improper. And that's exactly what we have here. What the Court of Appeals did in this case is it misunderstood its decision. It now took the burden standard from a remedy section and added it to trespass. And what's the effect? Now, somebody can come on my property, have no business being there. This is a good example. A person came on to my client's property, a club member. They would be permitted. They also brought seven strangers, totally unrelated to the club. Their sole goal was not to go to the 120 acres. It was to go to 40 acres unrelated to the club. And that's exactly what they did. So my clients now are in a situation, they have strangers coming on their property, not to use the 120 acres, but to use strangers' property. Without their permission, not even a telephone call. This is a trespass. And yet what the Court of Appeals did now said that, well, that's not enough burden, that's a trifle. The property owner simply has to allow that. Let me get to the actual incident so we know what is undisputed, because this was summary judgment. This occurred during the 2007 deer season. A gentleman who owned property about a quarter mile to the land of the club, unrelated to the club, was hunting down there with a group. That's 100 acres. After they got done hunting, there was another 40 acres they hadn't yet hunted. That 40 acres bordered the club's land.
Is this your picture on page 9 of your
Yes, break? It is, Your Honor. That is, and on page 9, the 100 acres is in the far bottom side. That's where they were hunting. They then decided to hunt the 40 acres, which is on the immediate south of the club's 120 acres. The club does not own this. It's unrelated to the club. This one member, plus these other seven hunters, decided, well, we want to hunt that 40 acres. Now, they just could have driven there without invading anybody's. But they decided, no, they wanted to hunt from the north first, coming down south. So they decided to do it that way. They would come onto my client's property, no telephone call, no permission, no advance notice. They simply came on. What they did is they drove on the public road, got to my client's property, drove across the property to the club's property, parked their car, jumped over the fence, and then hunted the 40 acres as they planned to do. They didn't hunt the 120 acres. They had no intention of doing that. That's what they did that day.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
The deed was, or the easement, was between four people.
Yes.
Two individuals, the grantors, two of the individuals were the grantees. Obviously, the club bought from the grantees. Right? So now we have not two people or their family and friends. We have a club, which has, and their invitees and their guests. And apparently there was a dispute, misunderstanding, or an issue in 1990-1991. And it went to a trial court to decide how does this easement now, how is it to be interpreted now that you got a club, right? And the interpretation, see if I can remember where it is, but as I remember the interpretation of the trial court, it was that the club and all of its invitees, all of its members, invitees and guests could use this easement to get to the club land, ingress and egress, and I can't remember if it says for club purposes or not, but essentially that's what it is. And it is in your brief, and if you point me to the page, it'll help us all. So what are we looking at in this case? Are we looking at the original deed, which was between four people, or are we looking at the deed or easement as interpreted for the club? Because one of the members of the club is apparently the host for all these other people and taking them and using the club easement. So which is it?
Your Honor, when I started this lawsuit, first of all, I was involved in the 1991, and Justice Ziegler, I'll address that in both. I was involved in the 1991 case, too. First, in answer to your question, I think because of the lower court's decision, it held in this case that the 1991 decision was not violated, didn't apply. I frankly disagree with that. I think it was. But that's what was held. That did not, the lower court in this case decided that did not address common law trespass. And so that, the common law trespass is the one that is currently before you.
Well, and the easement itself doesn't address common law trespass.
No,
neither one of them does.
No, they never do. Is that this is a standard easement, and then easement law, of course, depends upon this court to construe what are the rights that are inherent.
Or any court.
Now, so why you understand why I believe, and just so you know about the 1991 case that was asked about, in that case, the club brought that lawsuit. I believe, personally, now, I believe that's because they misunderstood what an easement is. I think they believed it was like a fee, that they actually owned that 40-foot strip. The reason is, and I'm looking at their summary judgment decision from back then, at that time, they wanted the right to park cars along the easement. The reason is they didn't want to occupy any of their 120 acres for hunting. Well, you can't do that on an easement. They also wanted the right to not only turn cars around on the easement, but to back off the easement onto other portions of my client's land, because, again, they didn't want to use up their 120 acres. And lastly, they wanted the right to use the easement for anything that they wanted to do, including to invite farmers, outside farmers, to farm their land off
the
easement.
That's right. And the easement, and the court said no go.
Right. And here's what, and I believe that the court properly construed Wisconsin law. Here's what the judge in 1991 ruled, which I believe was violated. He wrote, this is Judge Becker, 1991, since plaintiff is a corporation with members, the members have a right to use the easement. Service vehicles and emergency vehicles also clearly have that right. I'm satisfied that invitees to plaintiff's property may also use the easement for ingress and egress. The plaintiff cannot, however, grant the use of the easement to others. The plaintiff was the club. So I'll read that again. The plaintiff cannot, however, grant use of the easement to others. It cannot grant the right to use this easement as a means of gaining access to other properties by parties who are not using plaintiff's property. I stop right there. That's exactly what happened. We have one of the club members inviting seven non-club members to come on to Barb Greigel and Janet Nahorn's property, not to use 120 acres, but to use 40 acres outside the 120.
That came within the exact language of the circuit court saying can't give this right to the farmer.
Right. And so it was construed by, well, that just meant farmers. Well, that's not what the language said. There was a concluding paragraph. I'll read it, or a concluding sentence. It goes on. In other words, the plaintiff cannot extend the easement. The defendants, under the terms of the easement, have the right to extend its use to others. I'll read that. The defendants, that's my client. The defendants, under the terms of the easement, have the right to extend its use to others, but the plaintiff does not have that right. Plaintiff has no right to grant use of the easement to some farmer who is not going on to plaintiff's lands for any purpose, but simply using the easement to get to his own property. Okay, that was an example. But it was then construed, I think wrongly, that, oh, this is just a farmer's issue. Well, it's not, of course, whether you're a farmer, a hunter, a fisherman, whatever. So I believe that, and I brought a claim based upon this 1991 saying that this was violated.
Nay, Court of Appeals says that, paragraph 5.
And I think it was plain. All right. Now, what is the law? The law in this state, because of pertinent, I said, this goes back to this court's decision in Cecil versus Alvey. That's a 1960 decision. And it reads, A right-of-way appurtenant to a particular lot cannot be used as a mode of access to another lot to which it is not appurtenant, even though there is no resulting burden. Why? That's a property right. This is much like if I have mineral rights in my property or air rights, my next-door neighbor can't take some of my minerals and say, well, it was de minimis. It didn't burden you much. That's not you don't waive those rights that way. These are property rights. If I give permission to somebody to go up to 120 acres, you can do that. But you have no right then, as somebody going to the 120 acres and say, well, I think I should be able to go to these 40 acres or these 60 acres. It's not your right. And it's not a burden question. It's not a balance question. That's an ownership question. The owner has the right to control his or her own property. So this has been the standard rule. And what has been the Court of Appeals? The Court of Appeals did not mention Seashell by any means, none whatsoever. The Court of Appeals, in effect, held that because of Millen, and I believe it's misreading of Millen, it now held that when somebody misuses an easement, trespass, that whether or not you get a declaration of a trespass to prevent them from doing it again, nominal damages, that there first has to be a showing that it burdened you. And if it's not enough burden, you just have to bear with it. So an easement owner can, as the club would do, their 75 members now have the right. If they want to go on that 40 acres, it's up to them. My clients have no basis to stop not only 75 people from doing that, but if they want to invite 7 other people to do it, they have no recourse. They just have to allow that to be done. What does this mean? Why is this case in front of the Supreme Court? I believe this is a very important case. And that is, this is a dramatic change of property law in this state. Up till this time, property owners had the right to dictate how their property is going to be used, who's coming on it, and for what purpose they're coming on to. And if somebody wants to expand that, they have no right as the permittee to make a decision about, well, who's coming on and what they're going to do. No. If you want to go to other property and things like that, you have to go back to the owner. That's the owner's rights to say who's on their property. And for my clients, that's very important. The net result is this. If this new rule, in this case handed down by the Court of Appeals, is allowed to stand, in other words, coming on to easements, even where it's undisputed ultra vires use for unrelated lands, what's that's going to be? In this case, you had 7 strangers coming on to my client's property, no consent, unrelated lands, clear misuse, and outside the permission of the express contract. Well, first of all, you're going to encourage easement users, not owners, users. They now have a decision. If they want to expand their easement, they can do it. And what's the sanction? They're going to have to, you can force the owner. You'll have to go to court on a case-by-case basis to find out, well, is 7 enough to be a burden? How about 8 people? How about 9? This case was 3 or 4 cars. What if they brought trucks next time? And think of the court system. Now the court system is going to be burdened, as opposed to getting out the legal instrument and saying, wait a minute, this instrument says 120 acres. Were you using this for the 120 acres? No. Well, then you're trespassing. You have no right to do that. Now, every trial court is going to have to listen to say, well, yeah, but I was only on there for 10 minutes. And I only had 6 people this time. I went to 120 acres, but I only had 6 people. And I didn't bring cars. I brought ATVs this time. Are these the sort of rights that this court is prepared to tell trial judges throughout the state, this is now what you have to accept, that the test for trespassing is burdening people and de minimis? I think that the standard rule that has been this court's rule for over 100 years is the correct rule. It is a bright line rule. I'm a practicing lawyer, and as a practicing lawyer, of course, clients, when you tell them, that, oh, this is a gray area, you're going to have to go to court, it's hard for them to believe that. They disbelieve it. They think there should be rules. And I'll tell you, the real estate industry, property owners throughout the state, they want clear rules. If you have permission to go to 120 acres, you have permission. If you're going off the 120, if you're serving 40 acres, 80 acres, whatever, you don't have permission to do that. That's why the real estate group, unsolicited by us, filed an amicus brief. They call it the clarity rule or something like that, the traditional rule. That is the traditional rule. I think it serves this state and this court best in terms of not only the administration of justice, but also honoring contracts and also honoring the expectation of owners throughout this state.
Thank you, Mr. Rothstein. find my notes. Here they are. Mr. Grady, Lance S. Grady, representing the Fish and Game Club.
May it please the court, counsel, ladies and gentlemen of the galley, my name is Lance Grady, and along with Daniel Miller, we represent Monsha's Fish and Game Club in this appeal. Mr. Carl Scheip is also present this morning. If the court ends up reversing the Court of Appeals decision, it will actually result in a drastic change in the law, and I will demonstrate that to the court this morning. There are actually three issues before the court. First, do we have a violation of the 1991 judgment by Carl Scheif? Two, on November 24, 2006, did he commit common law trespass? Three, do we have a breach of the easement contract? And let's not forget, this is a one-time event. November 24, 2006, Carl Scheif went on to the unrhymed property. We are not talking about a situation where there's repeated use of that property. This is a one-time event. In terms of the resolution of those three issues, it's very easy.
It's a one-time event. Why wasn't this just settled and said, hey, we're not going to do it again?
Well, Your Honor, that's a very good question.
I usually ask them.
We live, I believe, in a very litigious society, and I think that's why we are here this morning. The issue could not be resolved. And, Judge, we don't have a violation of the 1991 judgment. If you look at that judgment, that granted the club and the club's invitees the right of ingress to the club's property. And on November 24, 2006, Carl Scheif basically exercised that right.
Did he have to go to the club property to get to the other property?
Actually, they went to the club property, Judge, so that they could park their vehicles. And once they parked their vehicles on the club property, they then walked over to the unrhymed property. So there was a purpose in using the club's property on November 24th. They in no way violated the explicit language of the 1991 judgment.
Back in 91, was Judge Becker given the circumstances presented here? Judge, you know, if we want to go to other property that's somewhat near this 120 acres, can we do that so long as we, you know, touch third base before we go home? We go to the 120 first and then we can head out wherever we want. Was Judge Becker deciding that?
Actually, Your Honor, what the issue that arose in the 1991 lawsuit dealt with the issue of farmers who were causing damage to the easement, and they wanted to access their farmlands through the club's property. And the court said that the club could not grant permission to third parties to use the easement to access other lands. The club did say,
So if the farmers joined the club, could they do it then?
Well, that was an issue, actually, that arose after the judgment was rendered as to whether the farmer should join the club and become club members. But the 1991 judgment indicated that club members and their invitees had every right to use that easement. Also,
any purpose at all? I just didn't get that from Judge Becker's decision. He was presented with those issues?
For ingress, yes, because of the farmer situation. The question arose as to whether third parties could use the easement to access their farmlands, and Judge Becker said no.
Why wasn't the farmer an invitee in that case?
Your Honor, I'm not exactly sure, but my thought is that in all probability, these farmers were using that easement without the presence of club members being present so that they could farm their lands. In this case, we have Carl Scheif with his invitees, and that's stipulated to using the easement for ingress on the day in question. We also do not have common law trespass here because...
Counsel, do I infer correctly that your characterization of this as a one-time event, I'd like to go back a few minutes, when you called this, you called our attention to your observation and characterization that this was a one-time event. Is that an implicit recognition that your opposing counsel is correct in his analysis of Millen and the application of it here, that it would be a one-time event to be litigated to determine whether the one-time event created enough of an additional burden. And that would be litigated through the courts, and then whatever the determination of the trial court would be at that time, if there was another one-time event, then it would be up to the owners of the Servient estate to litigate that to determine whether that was an increased burden.
Your Honor, the significance of the fact that this is a one-time event goes into assessing whether there's an added burden on the Servient estate. And that is why I raise that point.
By this one-time event or by the practice, what would be the practice then of using the Servian estate to go to the additional 40 acres and not the club land?
I think the court has to follow the added burden analysis, which has been in existence in the law for over 100 years.
For each event, for each episode.
If it is brought to the court's attention, yes, that is the analysis that must be followed. And with respect to the common law trespass, we do not have a trespass here on the unrined property because Mr. Scheif and his invitees are hunting on the unrined property with permission. The trespass comes into play if there is an enlargement of the easement. And if you go back in the case law for over 100 years, the way we determine if there is an improper enlargement of the easement is through the added burden analysis. And as Judge Reshefsky noted, as well as the Court of Appeals, the imposition on the easement was the same regardless of whether they hunted the club property or whether they hunted on the unrined property.
Counselor, you agree that this is an easement appurtenant, don't you?
Yes, I do, Your Honor.
Okay. And do you also agree that with an easement appurtenant, there are two estates that are created, the Servient estate and the dominant estate?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And the club would be the dominant estate? Correct?
That is correct.
All right. Isn't this, according to what's being presented to us by the plaintiffs, an attempt to change the description of the dominant estate?
How so, Your Honor?
Well, you know, the case law says that the dominant estate is the one that gets a right on another person's property for, in this case, a particular use. So the dominant estate got the right to go back and forth on the plaintiff's property to get to their property, okay? And that's the dominant estate. There are cases where you don't know for sure what the dominant estate is because of a description problem or a lot of other things. Here we know what it is. But what these people wanted to do was not get to the club. They wanted to go hunting somewhere else. And that somewhere else is not part of the dominant estate, right?
Actually, it's not a change in the dominant estate, Judge. The configuration of the dominant estate remains the same, and I think if you look at case law, there's multiple cases out there, including Millen, which deals with the after-acquired property situations. Here, the dominant estate remains the same.
Right, but that is the only land that's to be served by the easement, and you're using the easement under the facts, as I understand them, to serve other lands because these folks wanted to get to other lands, right?
Your Honor, as the Court of Appeals noted, there is absolutely no legal authority which stands for the proposition that an easement holder, once they arrive at the dominant estate, must remain on the dominant estate.
But that's a different question. The question is, here, are you using it to benefit access to another piece of property? And I think the Kresge case says you can't. It goes to the dominant estate. Now, if you wanted to get permission from the Servient estate holders and pay more money, maybe they'd give you a broader right. But that's not what's being argued here.
Actually, Your Honor, what is occurring here is that the Servient estate are trying to dictate what activities take place on the dominant estate.
No, I don't think so. They're complaining that your purpose was to get to other lands, and I didn't think you disputed that.
Well, there's multi-purposes involved here, Your Honor. The Scheif and his invitees are using the the easement for ingress to the club property so they can park. And then they hunt on the Unrein property, which basically they had the right to do on the Montes Club property. And when you look also with respect to the Kresge decision is not as simple, and with all due respect, as you have just represented. If you recall, in Kresge, it dealt with the use of an alley. And what we see in Kresge is that the use of the dominant estate changes. Initially, the dominant estate was a barber shop. And then what we see is the dominant estate changes into a retail outlet and a warehouse facility. And the court then notes, it follows the added burden analysis, and it notes that there's an increased burden on the easement caused by a change in use of the dominant estate. And we don't have that here. There is no change in the dominant estate. The dominant estate, in this case, remains the same.
Isn't the real effect, if we follow your logic, that no one's really going to ever want to grant an easement because they won't know what it means?
Right. I do not believe that, Your Honor. I think if the petitioner's position is adopted, let's imagine that this was homestead property instead of hunting property, and Carl Scheif was the owner of that homestead. If the petitioner's position is adopted, if Mr. Scheif wants to leave his home, he has an easement to get to his house, like many landowners do through the state of Wisconsin. Let's say upon arrival at his house after using the easement, he then wants to walk across his boundary to talk to his neighbor. If the petitioner's response, or if their approach is adopted here, when Carl Scheif walks across the boundary to talk to his neighbor, he's committing common law trespass. He's breaching the easement contract. And that simply is not the law in the state of Wisconsin. Under those circumstances, there would not be an added burden on the servient estate.
So that's used for his home. If he decides that, gosh, I don't need 120 acres to live on, and by the way, these farmers don't want to farm anymore, so they'll sell me another 300 acres. You know what I think I'm going to do? I think I'm going to subdivide all this property and sell it off to different people. So does that then mean that all those people can use his easement to get to the homes that he decides to subdivide off?
Your Honor, and that's the Gomerick decision by this court. In Gomerick, the dominant estate was subdivided into multiple parcels.
But I'm saying not just the dominant estate, but he acquired another 300 acres besides the dominant estate.
Okay, under
subdivided all of it.
Under those circumstances, the additional 300 acres that he purchases are not originally part of the dominant estate. As a result, they would not have the right to use that easement. You have to look at what consists of the dominant estate when the easement rights are granted.
What if he decides, gee, you know, I don't really like this house anymore. It's kind of old. I want to live in one of my new houses. And he lives on the new 300 acres.
If he lives on the property that was not originally part of the dominant estate, then arguably he does not have easement rights. We submit that this court should follow the case law established in Gomerick, in Kresge, in Rice. That is, in order to determine if there's a trespass, in order to determine whether there's an enlargement of the easement, the court has to follow the added burden analysis. And in this case, there is no added burden on the estate simply by Carl Scheif walking over onto the Unrein property and hunting with permission.
Counselor, obviously from what we're doing here, since we're all at the Supreme Court, this is not meant to be something that's never going to happen again. You're trying to establish a right that a club member can bring whoever they want onto the club property, either park their cars or maybe not park their cars, and then go hunt any kind of property that touches on the club, right? I mean, that's what we're here for. We're not here for one little deal or the folks would have settled this.
Your Honor, I disagree.
If this is never going to happen again, then I'm not sure why we are all spending so much money coming to the Supreme Court.
And, Judge, I completely agree with that as well. I don't know why this is before the Supreme Court, because this was a one-time event.
Well, so far. But, I mean, what you're trying to do is establish rights in that this can occur whenever a club member wants to bring other folks and park their cars at least on the club property, or maybe just walk through the club property and go somewhere else. Otherwise, there's no reason for us all to be here.
Your Honor, with all due respect, I see.
Go ahead. Sure, go ahead.
Thank you. We did not petition the Supreme Court. We are not trying to establish rights here. We are simply arguing to the court that under the facts and circumstances, we do not have a common law trespass, we do not have a violation of the 1991 judgment, and we do not have a breach of the easement contract.
Okay.
Those are
so
the
you're
facts
just defending
before this
yourselves.
Court. I'm sorry?
You're just defending yourselves.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Thank
That's
you.
Fair answer.
May I ask one question?
Go ahead, Justice.
Is there any
Roger.
Dispute that extra hunting land is accessible through other means?
I know, Your Honor, there is not a dispute on that. In fact, I believe some of the invitees in Carl Scheif's party were the Unrines. They just decided to, I believe, conduct a deer drive, I believe, from the north side of the property. And so they parked their cars on the club's property and began the drive on the north side of the property.
I just have to ask one question. Following up on Justice Rogan's side, why don't you just, if this was a one-time deal, never going to do it again, never going to happen again, when they brought the lawsuit, why don't you just stipulate to whatever they were asking for and say it will never happen again? Right. We agree the easement doesn't give us that right. It'll never happen again.
Your Honor.
Your answer in the record.
I think if
well,
you...
Maybe the way the record speaks to that is that you defended it and you asked the judge to grant you certain relief.
You must recall that both parties involved in this lawsuit purchased the properties after these easement rights are created. And I think if we acquiesced to the plaintiff's demands originally, in effect, we would be allowing them to dictate what the club's activities are on the club's land. And I do not believe that was acceptable to the club.
Okay, fair enough.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Counsel. Thank you, Mr. Rothstein.
Your Honor,
5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. Your Honor, you asked, and also Chief Justice, you asked, and Justice Ziegler, you asked, why hasn't this been settled? Is this a one-time event? The farmers in 1991, their names were Unrine. The people in this current one who were brought on, the seven strangers, they included the Unrines again. It's unfortunate. This goes on. My clients tried to. In the record, this is part of the records, my clients stipulated just to take nominal damages. That's all they wanted, nominal damages and their costs. Just why? Just to get a declaration to stop this, because it won't be a one-time event. Their fear is that what if the club now leases that 40 acres or another 80 acres or 60 acres? Well, they always have this argument that it wasn't a burden to you, so that's why. Number two, did Justice or Judge Becker addressed this in 1991. No, at that time, the club was trying to get rights for the Unrines as farmers to come on and just use the easement. That was refused. Justice Becker back at that time was not presented with the question of, well, how about just bringing strangers on and hunting? Is that okay? I believe Justice Becker, Judge Becker, would have clearly said, no, that's exactly consistent with his decision. Number three, Justice Gableman, you asked whether or not, well, this is a one-time event. Does that excuse it? I would present to the court this court's decision in Jacques v. Stenberg, where somebody trespassed one-time event and they asked for $100,000 because they deliberately trespassed, brought a mobile home across a property, and the defense was, well, we didn't do any harm, so no harm, no punitive damages. This court held that the right of ownership, every time there's a trespass, there is necessarily damage to the owner's rights to control his or her own property.
Oh, I'm not sure you apprehended my question correctly. I was actually trying to flesh out to see whether he agreed with your point that you made earlier, that it would be a one-time event as described and characterized as what could be a multiple or infinite series of events requiring court. Well,
you're right. And also with that, even a one-time event, don't forget this, is that easements can be expanded through adverse use. So if this is sort of the nose of the camel under the tent, they come on, they expand it. Well, I guess either we have to sue, go to court, see if there's enough burden this time. But now the rights are accreting, gaining. And that's why this court held in Kresge that a property owner, even for a first time, and even if the use is reasonable, if it's not permitted, you're entitled to a declaration of no trespass.
Could I ask you, counsel, on your diagram on page 9.
Yes.
You have the easement strip. What is directly above that easement? Who owns that property?
It's not owned by my clients. It's not owned by the club. It's some third party. That also borders the road, Aaron Road out there. I don't know who owns it. It's privately owned. I did want to answer your question, though, Justice Prosser. You asked whether or not the 40 acres that was clearly accessed in this case could have been accessed otherwise, and the answer is clearly yes, no dispute. As a matter of fact, Mr. Scheif, in the past, has gone from the 100 acres, stayed on unrined land, went to the unrined 40 acres. There's no access problem. They can drive right to it within 10 feet and walk there. They just chose, in this occasion, they didn't want to go that way. They preferred to go through my client's property. Lastly, and there was a statement that, and this is troubling, I think, what happens about, I have an easement to my house. Okay, it's landlocked. I go to my house. Does that mean I'm stuck? I can't walk to my neighbors? The answer is no. And there is, the law resolves that, common law. There was a statement that there is no law in that. It's found in the Restatement of Law of Property, Volume 5, Servitudes from 1944, and I'll read it. They're talking about easements appurtenant. And here it is. It's Section 478, Restatement of Property of the Law, Volume 5, Servitudes from 1944. It's Comment E. Now, this is actually talking about easements that I think are obtained by prescription, but I think it has the same effect. It reads this. It is the purpose of the user at the time he is making the use in question that determines whether it is within the scope of the easement. A change in the purpose after the use has been completed so that the non-dominant land will be benefited does not make the use improper. It goes on. That's kind of confusing. Thus, if one has a right-of-way over White Acre, appurtenant to Black Acre, intends to go to Black Acre, while using the way, he is within the scope of the easement, though after he leaves White Acre, he does not go to Black Acre, but decides to go and does go to Green Acre instead. Let me give you that again. Black Acre, Green Acre, I'll use my clients.
Sounds like a law school exam.
I'll finish it. But if one who has an easement of way over White Acre, appurtenant to Black Acre, uses the way with the purpose of going to Green Acre, the use is improper, even though he eventually goes to Black Acre rather than to Green Acre. What's this saying? When I'm right at the step using the easement, if my intention is not really to go to Black Acre, I'm going to go beyond it. And I start on that use is improper then and there. On the other hand, if my intent going to the original dominant estate is proper, I'm going there. I happen to get there, I change my mind or something, and then I'm going someplace else. The law does not prohibit that.
Well, then how does a court write an opinion that says that?
Well, in this case, it's pretty clear is that this is summary judgment. It was undisputed in this case. In this case...
Well, what about the fact that they parked their cars on that land, the club land? I mean, there was a purpose in going there. To use criminal law terms, is the second purpose, how far does it have to be attenuated?
Well, in this case, I can't answer that, Your Honor. I don't know. I do know in this case, this is a clear case. I mean, the record is undisputed here. In this case, there's just no doubt that at the time this individual came on to the easement was not for purposes of using this area. They intended this as part of a hunting expedition to hunt 40 acres. That's exactly what they did. And then they came to retrieve their cars later.
Oh, is that the way you want the opinion written?
I think that this court
should... How would you write the opinion?
I would write the opinion is that the standard rule this court has handed down since 1878 and in the Seashell case most recently is that the parameters, the real estate circumscribed by an easement, the written easement, designates the land to be served, and you may not use an easement for purposes apart from that land, period. That's the law, and that's how it should read. Oh. And in this case, that clearly was not the case. It was used for other purposes, and that's a violation. With that, I'm done. The stipulation is on record, by the way, that my clients did ask, and they haven't withdrawn that. They simply wanted a declaration of the trespass, of their nominal damages, and of their costs, so there's no requirement for further proceedings in the court below.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Rothstein. Thank you, Mr. Grady, for your arguments on our last easement case for February. That closes the hearing on 08-AP-2028, Rigel versus Fish and Game Club. The court will be in recess until 1:30. The students should remain here, and Justice Brooks will be out to speak with them. Everyone is invited to attend that session. We are in recess.